The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to the Guardian Football Weekly. Exciting times at Arsenal as fans return to see Pierre-Emerick Aubameyang finally scoring from a cross and Granit Xhaka showing the kind of passion they've been craving for years. What next for Arteta then? Will he get the time? Will his perfect hair turn grey overnight? Fulham and Palace hold Liverpool and Spurs while behind them Leicester and Southampton turn in the performances of the weekend. And what has happened to Sheffield United? We'll speak to someone who's watched every minute of them so you don't have to. Praise be, Everton are seventh, Newcastle win again and West Ham are good. There'll be a minute or two on Norwich leading the Championship and what exactly is a meatball header. All that plus your questions and that's today's Guardian Football Weekly. On the panel today, Paul McInnes. Hello.
Good morning. How are you doing, Max?
Yeah, I'm really good. Thanks very much. Hello, Barry Glendenning.
Hello, Max Rushton. How are you?
Yeah, lovely. Jonathan Wilson. Good morning.
Morning.
Hi, everybody. Just to say that at the moment we finished recording the pod today, we found out the sad news about Gerard Houllier, who's passed away at the age of 73. So we thought the best thing to do would be to pay tribute to him at the top of the podcast and then play you the pod that we'd recorded without knowing the sad news. A 35-year managerial career, including spells at Liverpool, Villa, Lyon, PSG, and, of course, with the France national team. He's been awarded the Légion d'honneur for his services to French football, an honorary OBE for services to British football. Possibly the highlight of his career was Liverpool's five cup success of 2001, the UEFA Cup, the FA Cup, the League Cup, the Charity Shield, the UEFA Super Cup, while he claimed European Coach of the Year, the Alf Ramsey Award, and World Soccer Magazine World Manager of the Year that year. Jonathan, very sad news.
Yeah, hugely sad. I mean, I met him a couple of times. He was always very pleasant, very nice. Obviously, had a great love of football. And, you know, as well as all his club success, yeah, he was a huge part of putting the structure in place, which led to France winning a World Cup in 98. And I guess the continued success of the French youth systems, that he was very heavily involved in that. So, yeah, somebody who's had a huge influence over football in the last sort of 30 years or so. And I think from people who met him will be remembered as somebody who was always very pleasant, always very willing to engage in conversation about football.
And that success, Paul, at Liverpool, when they hadn't had success for quite a long time, and sort of memories of that sort of treble, that kind of treble that he won.
Yeah, I mean, it was they won it with some great the Alaves Cup final, and Robbie Fowler's dribble goal was, you know, an incredible moment. He created a lot of great moments for Liverpool. He also brought through young English players, young Scousers. You know, Steven Gerrard came on under his watch. Michael Owen was developed. It was something that Danny Murphy in that team, you know, he always looked like going to be a lost Liverpool talent. That was something that allowed him to connect with the Liverpool, the city and the fan base more broadly. I was at the Roma game where he came back from heart surgery, and it was a Champions League group game. I think they needed to win to go through, but I don't think it was the decisive match. But it's one of the most sort of memorable experiences I've had watching football, because, and I know, you know, there's been lots in Liverpool's more recent history, but that connection between the crowd and the coach, it was visceral. You felt it. It shook your ribcage. It was it made you appreciate and understand and feel the power of football that it has to connect people. And you know, I think Houllier did bring that to Liverpool.
I do remember when he had his heart issues, there was enormous groundswell of good feeling towards him. You know, he was much loved on Merseyside, and that will be a blow for Liverpool and their supporters.
Oh yeah, Gary Lineker just tweeting, one of football's smartest, warmest and loveliest people. RIP Gerard, Gerard Houllier, who's passed away at the age of 73. Now we'll go back to part one of the Guardian Football Weekly, starting at the Emirates. Before we get into the games, Rob says, currently teams in Tier 2 are averaging 2 points per home game, against a pre-lockdown average of 1.66. Is this apparent unfairness sustainable, or is the greater good of the game more important? Jonathan, it's got numbers in it. Sounds like a question for you.
I mean, the sample size is tiny. Even if it weren't tiny, I couldn't care less. There's far, far, far greater iniquities in modern football than the fact that some clubs can have 2,000 fans and some clubs can't. I don't care.
Okay. Paul, do you care or not?
I agree. I was going to use sample size. I thought if it comes to me, I'm going to say sample size because it's right. Obviously, Jonathan got there first, but yeah, there's barely been any games to go. I mean, there was some research that I wrote about in the summer, which had looked at all the restart leagues across Europe and found that there hadn't been any home advantage, any loss in home advantage without fans. Now, that appears to have slightly changed as we've gone into this second season, but I'm not sure it's been studied at such great breadth. But I think in England, it seems that the home advantage is lost again. So maybe if it brings it back again, it's a natural equilibrizer or something.
Okay. Well, there were fans at the Emirates, but Arsenal didn't win. Steven says, does anyone agree that hearing Arsenal fans booing their own team makes it feel like things are returning to normal? Crisis time. Is it a crisis, Barry? Haven't won since the 1st of November. 1 point since then. They only won once in October. They're not very good. And I think a lot of people thought Burnley could get something from this.
I think Arsenal were the better team and Burnley got a little bit lucky. But Arsenal, they're always in crisis. And there was a brief period last season when they weren't, and Mikel Arteta had them playing pretty good football, and I don't really know what's happened to them, but I think it seems the only way you can get out of that Arsenal team is to get injured or suspended. He keeps picking the same players over and over and over again, and they keep failing to deliver the goods. We saw in midweek when they played Dundalk, who admittedly aren't particularly anywhere near Arsenal's level, even the current Arsenal's level, that they do have a lot of youngsters, but Arteta doesn't seem to have faith in them to deliver in important Premier League games, but the players he does have faith in repeatedly let him down, so it's difficult to know what he can do. I mean, his hand has been forced now because Granit Xhaka will miss 3 games through suspension, and Hector Bellerin, I think, has due to sit out a game because he's got his fifth yellow card against Burnley. So he will have to pick some new players. Rhys Nelson will hopefully get a game. I think he should be in the side. But yeah, they are definitely in more of a crisis than usual.
Why aren't they good? They're 15th, Wilson. Where should they be, and why aren't they there?
I don't know what the wage bill is, but I would assume it is top six. So they should be top six. I mean, maybe you say, I don't know, Leicester or Southampton are playing particularly well at the minute, so seventh isn't a disaster. But they certainly should be higher than they are. What I don't understand is how good they appeared at the end of last season. You know, that game against City in the Cup semi-final, they were really good. The Cup final against Chelsea, they were very good. For the Community Shield, they held their own against Liverpool. They did seem to have a direction, but that for whatever reason has been lost. And, you know, Xhaka was playing well in the summer, but he's reverted to type. I think they have a problem with the squad, that the squad's not deep enough. And so when people like Aubameyang drop out of form, there's nobody obvious to come in. But then you look at some of their recruitment and you know, that Willian deal, for all I like Willian as a player, it looked an odd deal to give a player of that age so much money and such a long contract. And it looks even odder now because he really hasn't played well at all.
Paul, let's talk about Granit Xhaka. What exactly is he doing there? I mean, he gives away... It's one thing to react when someone fouls you, but to react when you fouled someone seems quite the stretch to me.
Well, yeah, I guess. I mean, we don't know if anything was said to him that upset him, but it's just a player not in control, isn't it? And a player who is desperate. I mean, I think a lot of this, for me, this Arsenal malaise is about a standard thing that we might end up talking about with Sheffield United as well, that actually these players were slightly overperforming when they were doing well, and that particularly led by Aubameyang, who was on this, you know, platinum streak of scoring. He's fallen away since the new contract for whatever reason, and I think that sort of exposes a lot of the liabilities elsewhere in the team a bit more. And Xhaka, you know, he has this temper. That's his natural mode of being. And getting him to not play like that and to sort of keep restrained was an achievement. But I'm not sure it's the sort of thing that can last forever. And we're just seeing that, you know, regressing to the mean.
Our friend Emmanuel Frimpong Barry, who once famously on our radio show, when asked, what's your favourite insect, replied, antelope. He said, sell Xhaka and get me on a free. I mean, Arsenal do have sort of discipline issues. The worst discipline in the league. Most yellows, 86, and reds, 5.
Well, I think Mohamed Elneny was very lucky not to get a red card for a pretty similar offence to Xhaka. I thought it was actually worse than Xhaka's, but...
Yeah, two hands, yeah, and then he threw himself...
Very lucky.
And he threw himself to the floor to simulate being fouled himself again. I mean, it was the double whammy.
I really liked Elneny putting his face in the turf to go, well, I'll just pretend that I've also been punched, despite the fact that there'll be video evidence pretty soon to show that nothing has happened to me. I've just buried my face in the turf. And from that is when Aubameyang scores... what some people have said, we were discussing glancing headers in detail on Thursday's pod, and Aubameyang comes out with, as Milk's Gone Off says, the finest example of a glancing header there could be, in front of the post when he makes contact, hits the side netting on the opposite corner. Class is permanent. They're not in a relegation battle, though, Jonathan, are they?
Well, they shouldn't be. I mean, this happened... last season as well, I can't remember exactly when, but just before Christmas, when you suddenly thought, hang on, could they get sucked into this? And they very quickly, got a tattoo in, I suppose, and got away from it. But the league is funny this year, that there does seem to be... Oh, I sort of thought there were four teams getting cut off. Now, obviously, Fulham and Burnley, Fulham particularly started to play well. Burnley, you get that win. So that gap is closing. Brighton, despite having played pretty well most of the season, seem to have got themselves into the battle. Leeds could easily get sucked in. But you sort of think, well, actually, how much longer does this need to go on before you would say Arsenal are in the fight? And the thing is, if you're a team like that, of Arsenal stature, with players of that stature who just aren't used to that, and you suddenly get yourself in that spiral, I think it can be really hard to get out of. So if you think of Leeds back in 2003-04, yeah, that squad should never have gone down. Yeah, the players were far too good to go down. But they had that sort of 5 or 6 years of constantly being around the Champions League places, and suddenly they get in a dogfight, and that's not the kind of football, that's not the kind of pressure they're used to, and they turn out to be totally unable to deal with it. Now, you look at this Arsenal squad, do you see many, many great leaders, many great fighters there? No. So... they shouldn't get involved in it, but it wouldn't entirely surprise me.
I mean, do they stick with Arteta throughout this crisis? I mean, how committed are the hierarchy to a project? Because it all looked nice and sounded nice when he came in. But if it gets to be after Christmas and they're in and around the bottom three, do they go, okay, you know, I'm trying to think of a more sophisticated continental example, but let's just say we sack him and get Big Sam. You know, that somebody who can come in and absolutely guarantee that this doesn't turn into a full-blown bin fire, you know?
I would love Big Sam. I'd absolutely love that. Apparently, there were rumours yesterday were lining up Max Allegri. You presume they'd go for a manager with experience. You know, Henri and Vieira are mentioned, and I know they have bits of experience, but, you know, I do find it strange that Arteta, who had managed, I believe, one football match when Pep wasn't there for a City game his entire life, is given a job of this stature, Jonathan. I mean, I don't know if that, you know, is that too simplistic for me to say that? There's this idea that you get a club legend in, and it's obviously not just Arsenal. It does seem strange where question one in the interview should be, have you ever done this before?
Yeah, I mean, I think any time you turn to somebody like that, there are major questions, and I'd say the same about Lampard, I'd say the same about Pirlo. And that, yeah, Lampard, even having had his year at Derby, That sort of fast-track process, I think, is hugely risky. Now, obviously, it can work. It worked with Guardiola. It worked brilliantly with Guardiola. And that, I guess, is what all clubs are trying to replicate, because it's the best of both worlds. You get a brilliant young manager with fresh ideas that other teams don't know how to deal with, who also happens to be a club legend. That's, yeah, it's ticking every single box. But those examples are very, very rare. Now, Arteta had a very, very good reputation. I think it had been pretty obvious from his latter days as a player that he would go on to be a coach. I think his work with Guardiola had impressed a lot of people. I presume he interviewed very, very well, although he had obviously lost out on the interview to Emery first time round. So I think his was more understandable than some of the other appointments, but it was always a huge risk. Now, I sort of think they need to stick with him. You know, I think you look at that squad and you think, well, there's huge problems in that squad that have got very little to do with Arteta. And at least he seems to have a plan. At least he seems sort of tough enough to ostracize the players he doesn't believe in. But there might have to be a lot of pain to go through first. Now, I also recognize that when you ask me exactly the same questions about Solskjaer, my answer is very different. And that comes down to some kind of gut reaction that I somehow believe in Arteta in a way I don't believe in Solskjaer, which I guess is just to do with how they present themselves.
Well, I think in the case of both, I'm the same as you, Jonathan. It's a gut reaction that makes me think Arteta is probably going to be turn out a better manager than Solskjaer. But there are a lot of problems above Arteta and above Solskjaer in the hierarchy. And Arsenal's recruitment has been pretty dismal in recent years. I don't know what input he has or had over the summer, but I think the problems at Arsenal go higher than Mikel Arteta.
On the recruitment, you know, our mate Elliot Ross, who's pretty sort of mild-mannered, sensible, well-thought-out bloke, saying, I don't wish to overreact, but I think paying off the remainder of Willian's contract at half-time could give Arsenal the shot in the arm we are crying out for. Most of the noise didn't come from the fans. It came from a water pump as well. Lots of people thinking there was something wrong with their telly, to the point where Martin Tyler had to actually announce what it was. It was sort of pumping out the rainwater. But look, a massive win for Burnley. Well done to them. They get out of the relegation zone with that victory. Before we go on to the two best performances of the weekend from Leicester and Southampton, let's congratulate Fulham and Palace for taking points off the top two. Liverpool and Spurs at Craven Cottage. Fulham won, Liverpool won. Liverpool have now dropped 11 points this season. They only dropped 15 in total last season. Fulham deserved at least a point from this, I think. What did they do right, Paul, in this game?
Well, thank you for asking, because I'd sort of wound up my Liverpool mates beforehand saying that Fulham were a very interesting team before the game. So I've seen them a couple of times. And basically, since Parker managed to... They went on such a shopping spree, a lot more under the radar than they did than 2 years ago, when the headline figure was over 100 million and they got called out for it. But they spent about 23 million this year, but brought in about a similar amount of players, about 8 to 10. And the terrible start of the season was without what is now the effective centre half pairing of Joachim Anderson and Tosin Adarabayo, and those two provide a platform along with Alphonse Areola, the on-loan keeper. They provide a platform that Fulham didn't have before, which is just, you know, effective, disciplined, physical defending, and they can build from that. Which means they play a slightly different game now. And they play with a lot more ball carriers in midfield, and they play to these pacey forwards, and they've changed. They're much more reactive counter-attacking team. And so yesterday he actually dropped Mitrovic, who was their talisman in the championship, and Tom Cairney, their skipper, played without them. They played brilliantly. They were smart, on the front foot, assertive, but also, you know, with real technical ability, to the extent that they largely outran or outmaneuvered Liverpool's fabled press. And once they got beyond that, they got in on the weakened back line, and it was only Alisson that kept them in the game in the first half. I mean, really, they could have been four goals up. Second half, you know, it's difficult for a team like Fulham to maintain that intensity all the way through, and Liverpool started to dominate again. Fulham should have had a penalty that was overturned by VAR. Then they got a penalty awarded, got a penalty confirmed by VAR, which I just thought was just one of those ones. Again, you just like everything that's bad about these new rules and the new systems. And it was a point in the end. And, you know, I think Fulham actually will be a little bit disappointed, because this was the chance to actually really make people sit up and go, whoa, this team are decent, because, you know, they've changed.
That Fulham penalty actually wasn't given, was it? And then no. Andre Mariner went to the screen and said, I'm sticking with my original decision.
Yes, sorry,
and
but it should have been.
I think you're right, but I'm not... I think you're right. I think it is a penalty, but
he absolutely went through his foot before getting to the ball.
It's definitely a penalty.
Okay, it's definitely a penalty.
But there's this bizarre thing now of people going, oh, but when I first saw it, you know, it looked like he took the ball. Yeah, but that's why VAR's there. you know, and so you know, had this been 3 years ago, the world before VAR, we wouldn't have bothered about it. It's like, okay, I can understand why the referee hasn't seen it, I can understand why he hasn't given it. We factor human error and the limitations of human perception into our assessment. Once you've got very clear video evidence that he slid in and kicked his foot, that it was Fabinho on Caballero, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Why is that not being given? We can see it. Just because it feels like it wouldn't have been given in the past, that's not what we're asking ourselves. And then, of course, the handball, which I guess is an offence, and I guess it, you know, would have been seen and given in the past, but it just sort of, you sort of feel in the sort of moral universe, which is worse, sliding in and kicking a man on the ankle, or jumping in the ball hitting you on the elbow when it might hit your mate in the chest anyway?
Yeah, and you know, was it because his arm was raised above his shoulder, and if so, it was, you know, by nano.
Well, his arm has gone out. I mean, you know, he probably now in a war should jump with your arm sort of folded across your chest.
Yeah, but strapped to your chest with a belt.
He did turn his back, which is the biggest crime in football, isn't it?
That is true. He has turned his back.
Crime. I'll tell you what's interesting about the first penalty is I was sure it was a penalty. It just shows how weak-minded I am until I watched Jermaine Genus on Match of the Day 2 saying, well, maybe it isn't a penalty. You know, I'm happy with the ref to stick with his on-field decision. Quite a good take. But I was convinced it was a penalty yesterday.
But this is exactly the point and the problem that VAR creates, that we take the grey area out of the equation. We were quite happy with grey areas. Maybe we weren't happy with them, but there was an acceptance of grey areas in the past. And now when your cameras are there, we have proof it's a penalty. And for some reason, in this instance, when loads of ridiculous pedantic penalties have been given, we've decided not to give this one. And that, to me, feels worse than a referee just not quite seeing it and not quite being sure.
I mean, how is that not a clear and obvious error? Because the referee must have not seen the foot contacting the foot, which is clear, it's obvious, and it's an error. And that to me, it fits the definition of why it should be overturned. But,
well, clear and obvious just seems to me kind of a total red herring. It just complicates the issue. I don't think it helps at all, because we're now making two stages of decision. One, is it a penalty, yes or no? And two, to what extent is this an error? Which is itself clearly an arbitrary call. By definition, it's an arbitrary call.
Are you saying clear and obvious is too vague?
Yes.
Oliver says on Mo Salah's run-up gate, Mo didn't skip, but he went really far to the right. When will this end? Why haven't they outlawed anything other than a straight run-up with a maximum arc not exceeding 30 degrees?
Well, didn't Danny Murphy point out, I think it was when Cavaliero missed a penalty for Fulham in a game a while back, I can't remember who it was against, but that by increasing the arc, he was making it more difficult for himself. And that, when he planted his foot, it slipped out from under him and he ended up ballooning the ball high and wide. So I can't remember exactly what it was, but Danny Murphy gave a good explanation as to why you increase your chances of scoring with a straight run-up, and the more you arc it, the more difficult you make it for yourself to score.
Crystal Palace 1, Tottenham Hotspur 1. David says, why does every keeper turn into prime Buffon versus Spurs? I mean, he did make the mistake, Gaeta, for Kane's goal, but some good saves before and two brilliant saves in the dying minutes. I mean, they Wilson, were brilliant pieces of goalkeeping, weren't they?
Oh, superb. Yeah, I mean, he was having a great game, makes a mistake, and then manages to pick himself up and continues to have a great game. And those two saves in the last 5 minutes, the quick change of direction from the Kane header, and then the classic diving to the top corner, pushing it away from a Dier free kick, both fantastic saves.
It's an amazing photo of him saving that Dier free kick where his mouth is sort of wide open, like he's terrified, like he's stretching every single sinew in his entire body to get there.
And then also RoboCop and his brother in the stand, apparently.
Yes. That was very strange. But two fans had masks, as far as I could tell, over their eyes. Perhaps that's how you watch Crystal Palace. Although they're playing better football than they used to, aren't they? Gareth actually says, will you have more analysis of Crystal Palace, please? Last week was our first time we scored 5 goals and we got a one-sentence review from someone who was cooking dinner while watching the game. This change being more expansive and attacking has been great to watch for our fans. As a question mark... They were good, weren't they? And with Benteke there, Barry, like holding it up for Zaha and Eze, they've got they look good.
Yeah, well, Zaha and Eze are terrific players, and I think it was me last week who, I'm sorry for eating food. I would like to humbly apologise. I'll be honest, I didn't really see much of this game either, so you should direct your question to elsewhere.
Paul, some praise for Crystal Palace.
They've actually only had one defeat this season. I think the home defeat to Newcastle, which you would say goes against a narrative of success. Sorry, that's not a particularly elegant way of phrasing it. But anyway, they're still sort of mid-table, but actually their results have been pretty impressive. The win against West Brom was obviously a romp. I think what Eze has done is he's just added an extra dimension to the game, which is somebody who's got a range of passing from midfield. And I think that was what they sort of, from the games I've seen, you know, they would rely on MacArthur to do that, but that's not quite his game. And also Milivojevic, but from deep. So to have somebody who's willing to, perfectly able to sit in between the lines, dictate the tempo, dictate the play, also a great, you know, set piece threat too, I think does change the options that Crystal Palace have available to them. And, you know, the more options you have, the more you are, you know, utterly reliant on getting Wilf Zaha to, you know, click every game in order to score. So, you know, it's a slow process. It's a funny one with Palace because they were saddled with really high wages for, you know, a squad that actually wasn't that spectacular. Certainly didn't give a lot of attacking flair to the team. And so it's been a slow process of sort of slightly changing that. And sticking with a lot of players like Benteke, who, you know, other clubs in the Premier League would have, you know, done their very best to get shot of before now. But, you know, Roy obviously knows what he's doing. And I think, you know, we're at the stage now where hopefully they can kick on a little bit without the, you know, I'm sure Roy would always say the 40 points is the target, but you can kick on and try and be a little bit more expansive, a little bit more progressive, because A, you've got the players there that enable you to do that, but B, you're solid enough that you're not taking too much risk.
Jonathan, a bit of a wake-up call for Tottenham if they do have designs on winning the title, that they can't take the lead and sit back against these kind of teams?
Yes and no. I mean, apart from Gaeta having a brilliant game, they'd have won that quite comfortably. So I wouldn't be too worried about this. You can maybe make a case that more passing options deep in midfield, do they really need both Højbjerg and Sissoko? Maybe you can bring Winks in there. So if you look at the run of games recently when they've played Chelsea and Arsenal and Manchester City, that's been a difficult run, and they've taken 8 points from those four games. Obviously, Liverpool coming up midweek is huge as well, but you know, you will drop points at some places, and they probably deserve to win that game.
Richard says, can you start doing the punditry on the Mourinho masterclass goalless draw at Anfield on Wednesday already, please? Barry, how do you think that one's going to go? The biggest game of the full midweek programme?
That's hard to call, obviously. I mean, if Liverpool play like they did in the opening half hour against Fulham, they'll get battered. It's unlikely they'll play that badly again. I have, from time to time, mocked Jurgen Klopp for moaning about injuries, but I think yesterday you could see they really were missing Alcantara, they're really missing Van Dijk, and they're really missing Diogo Jota, none of whom I think are due back anytime soon. So I would not be surprised if Tottenham got a result. I would not be surprised if either side won, so I've got to sit firmly on the fence.
Mark says, Jose has stated he'd like to continue coaching into his 70s. What will the panel be doing at a similar age? Barry babysitting Max's grandchildren, maybe. Well, my kids would have to get a shift on if that was to happen.
You have to get a shift on first. Quite literally.
Right, that'll do for part one. Part two will begin at the King Power. Welcome to part two of the Guardian Football Weekly. Leicester City beat Brighton 3-0. They're a point off the top two. James Maddison's second. What a beautiful goal That is Paul. He's fallen down the England pecking order. Can he climb back up it? I mean, I know you must have watched a lot of him at Norwich.
Yeah, I did watch a lot of him at Norwich. And at the time, I thought he was the best technical player we'd ever had at the club in my far too many years of watching. Since then, I've gone off him a little bit. I don't think he's mobile enough to play in the either in a midfield three, and he's out of position if he's playing in a sort of inside forward role. So I've gone off him. But you know, the thing is, he's been injured, and he's only sort of getting back to peak form now. And you know, he's smart, and he is technically capable, and he can run with the ball in a way that I sort of underrated with him. And he is, you know, long range. He is probably, you know, up there. I'm trying to think of competitors, you know, as being one of the best long range shooters in the division. So yeah, he's great. I think, you know, Leicester have had some funny results, you know, four defeats already, but they've won their other eight. They've done it sort of in won some games just at a breeze. And so it's difficult to kind of like put a finger on where you think they are given the end of last season and the way the sort of, you know, collapse is maybe a bit strong, but they certainly fell away quite strongly where they are this season. But on their day, they're incredibly impressive. And I think they have that ruthless streak in them, which in this sort of division, I think, you know, where everything's so uncertain, that could mean quite a lot.
I mean, I like Maddison. He has a very high opinion of himself, which I don't mind because he has the swagger to back it up. But Leicester, on their day, they're a really good side. I wouldn't be at all surprised if they finish in the top four, but they are capable of falling or losing games you really wouldn't expect them to, you know, with a fair bit of frequency. That consistency is a bit of a problem, and Kasper Schmeichel had to keep them in the game in the first half hour yesterday, when I thought, you know, Brighton would it probably deserve to go at least one, if not two, goals up. But then that is Brighton to a T. They really have difficulty scoring goals, and they're nowhere near as good as I think they should be if they had someone who could put the ball in the back of the net with any sort of frequency. I think Brighton would be Leicester, if Brighton had Vardy, they would be in the position, or could be in the position Leicester are in now, and Leicester could be where Brighton are, but obviously that is not the case.
Yeah, I sort of agree that certainly that Brighton have, they feel like they've played better than the league position suggests, and I feel like every time I do watch them, when I do watch a full game, I quite often come away thinking, I don't quite know how they didn't win that. Scoring goals is clearly a huge problem for them.
James Justin played well, didn't he? Another good right back, which is just what England need.
Yeah. But he was playing on the left for a bit as well. They've just recruited well. I mean, I think I'd say about Brighton is, yeah, they've got technical players and they've got an attractive style of play, but I'm not sure they've necessarily assembled. It's not that they haven't bought a lot of players. I'm just not sure they've assembled the right tools for the box. And if you look at Leicester, that they've definitely, you know, progressed as a possession side under Rodgers, but they still have not given up or abandoned the way that, you know, caused them to win the league title. And when they've still got Vardy, that's still a possibility, which is, you know, make sure your counter-attacks are like lightning. And, Justin's cross for Vardy's goal, you know, just a simple little clip for Vardy, was because the cross, you know, I think might be his second touch or something, just at full pace, kind of caught off the side of the boot, whipped on and beyond the back line. That was brilliant. And that is one specific skill that you absolutely need to be able to deliver if you're going to be a team that kind of can shred people on the counter. And that's what, you know, that's one of the things that Justin can do.
Southampton 3, Sheffield United 0. Before we do Southampton being good, let's do Sheffield United not being very good. Bottom, 1 point from 12. The worst ever start in Premier League history. Even the Derby County side of 07-08 had 6 points by this stage. They did finish with only 11. So they really tailed off Derby, didn't they, in that season? Who knew that they'd had such a good start, a blistering start to the 07-08 season?
They had the huge advantage of playing Newcastle quite early that season, and that was when they got their only win. I think it was the third game of that season.
Really? Anyway, let's get an expert opinion on this. James Sosik from Blades Analytics Twitter account. James, how are you?
As well as can be expected today.
What's happened, James?
That's a bloody good question. Anything that can go wrong has gone wrong, to be honest. I think the first 10 minutes of the first game of the season at home to Wolves, we were 2-0 down, made mistakes that we didn't make for the whole of last season. We then got a man sent off within about 12 minutes at Aston Villa and then missed the penalty at 0-0. That went wrong there. And it's just kind of spiralled since there. Injuries to key players, loss of form, loss of confidence, and it's kind of brought us to this point where we are absolutely woeful.
Well, Jay, I haven't seen all your games, but the ones I have, apart from yesterday, United played quite well, particularly against Liverpool. I thought they were excellent. I was thinking, there's no way this lot will go down. And if you look for the number of points they've accrued, the goal difference after 12 games, it's only minus 16, which suggests, and results, they're not losing games by a lot. So, but it can't just be bad luck.
No, it's not. It's not just bad luck. I mean, I think before the weekend, there was this weird stat that we'd obviously spent the most time losing, we're bottom of the league, but we'd also spent the most time drawing, which goes to show how close the games are that we're in. It's a lot of single goal losses, but to be honest, in these single goal losses, it's games where we've just not taken our chances, the opposition has, and it puts us in a place then where the pressure's on us to try and score goals, which is something we're pretty poor at. We weren't very good at that last year. We weren't built on a good attack. We were built on a strong defence and keeping games tight and nicking goals. And that's not what we've been able to do this year. So the plan just isn't working right now.
I've seen a lot of pundits say it's second season syndrome and a lot of Sheffield United fans going, no, it isn't. Stop saying that. They were good last season and they're not very good this season.
I was one of those saying no, but then each week that goes by, I'm feeling a bit stupid about that now. I don't think it is. I don't think it is second season syndrome because I don't think we're playing the same way. We've lost Jack O'Connell, who is our left centre-back, and everyone knows, inverted commas, Sheffield United have overlapping centre-backs. I'm not sure that's actually true in the Premier League, but we did have a player there who was our best defender and one of our best players going forward, weirdly. And losing him has been disastrous. Everyone who's come in to replace him has either been poor or not up to the level so far. And teams are just attacking us down our left-hand side now. They're targeting it. West Ham targeted it last week. Southampton could have had the run of yesterday. I mean, we completed 9 passes in the first 20 minutes. Not one player. That was a whole team. I mean, oh, wow. That goes to show it all, really, doesn't it? But I just think that is a big... It is a big thing of the way we play. We cannot play the way we once did due to loss of form and confidence because of the momentum the side doesn't have.
Chris Wilder has so much goodwill at Bramall Lane. Like, I can't imagine a scenario where he gets the boot. But like, if they only had one point in May, like what happens?
Oh, I don't want to think about that, Max. not one single fan that I know, certainly not myself, not one single person wants Chris Wilder to get the boot, even if we end up with one point come the end of the season. What that man has done for our club is sensational, and I don't think that many other managers in world football could have done what he's done, to be frank. But there is a realisation that it gets worse week by week. The Derby thing comes into more realisation week by week. And we do have a chairman who may decide to pull a trigger at some point if things go worse. I don't know how the hell it goes worse, but if it does go worse, you know.
I found that Vardy goal, and when they had the camera on Chris Wilder, and you're watching John Egan going, oh, just kick him over. Like, you've got to foul him. That was like a real blow. Paul, did you want to come in?
Yeah, hi, Jay. Paul McInnes here. Big fan of your online work. And I saw you having a little chat yesterday about recruitment. And my question is, I wonder, you know, I'm thinking particularly Sander Berger, I know you're a fan of, and Rhian Brewster. These signings, good, you know, big sort of, progressive, get, you know, the sort of players that other people will want to have, Sheffield United get them. How much say is Chris Wilder having over that? Because I wonder whether they fit in with the characteristics that he would actually like in his team.
Yeah, it's probably a fair question, Paul. And I think it's one that, you know, especially in Sander Berger's case, where Sander's clearly a technical level above the rest of our side. You know, I don't think our players have any assumptions about that. Most of them know they're probably championship level on a technical perspective. You know, the effort is what's got them there. But almost since we've bought Sander in, we've almost lost something with the balance of the side. He's an exceptional, you know, huge, big ball carrier. He's got a lovely pass. He's good under pressure. he's athletic for the size that he is, and I've got no doubt he'll go to the top of the game. But having him in, we've lost a little bit of intensity out of possession. I mean, I think some of this does coincide with fans. I get it's the same for everyone, but if you look at the league table since lockdown happened and since fans haven't gone to football, Sheffield United are dead bottom of that table too. I think not many clubs in the Premier League have depend on that connection and that motivation that fans give them as much as United do. But yeah, I think Chris does have say. I think he does have the final say. I don't think he'd stay if he didn't. He's not the type to take being told what to do. But I do think that the recruitment in the summer looked okay on paper, but it didn't improve the first team. And I think that's been a massive problem, really. We've got some depth now, but the players aren't good enough in the first team at the minute, and we've got nothing to replace them with.
Are you saying your presence at Bramall Lane is more important than Sander Berg's presence at Bramall Lane?
I mean, I'm not one for with or without your stats, but, you know, this is... There's some merit to this, Max.
Wilson?
Can I ask? Obviously, what you want to happen is now is that you suddenly go on a run and you stay up.
Yeah.
But if you go down, would you rather go down and break the record? And I say this...
It's a legitimate question.
I say this as a Sunderland fan who had the record for low points at 19. We then improved that with 15... And then it's been cruelly ripped from us by Derby. And actually, I quite like that back. Nobody remembers just how bad we were. Would you like to take Derby's record?
I mean, perversely, maybe yes. I don't even know how to answer that at this. Probably yes, because if you're going to have a pants season, then have a pants season, right? You know, I mean, Sheffield United in my lifetime have had three seasons in the Premier League now. It isn't a consistent thing. It's quite nice sometimes to go in the Championship and have fun winning games every now and again.
So, yeah, we didn't do that either. Don't rely on that.
that's a good point.
Do you think you can get out of it?
I mean, no. Probably not at the minute, if I'm going to be honest. You don't know, because it's a weird league this year, isn't it? I know Burnley obviously won last night and Fulham played really well against Liverpool, but there's that bottom four that are detached, really. You know, Leeds have lost so many games in a row now, and we all love the way Leeds are playing, but surely any other season they'd be slightly more sucked in than what they are. There's just three or four really bad teams at the bottom that are quite detached, and Burnley and Fulham look like they're improving, so they're going to get away with that, and us and West Brom are just going to be caught out. I don't think we will get out of it now. Although I must say, it's almost becoming perversely cool in the sense that week by week now, we're all going to celebrate that first win so much. I think we're all just going to destroy ourselves. It's going to be incredible when we win a game.
Imagine if it happens over Christmas when the COVID restrictions are down as well. Chaos.
No. Disaster.
Don't.
Alison, thanks so much for coming on, James. Appreciate it.
Thanks, guys. Thanks for your time.
James Sosich there from Blades Analytics Twitter account. We should mention Southampton before Southampton fans get very annoyed with us. Fourth, 2 points off top spot. Redmond's goal was a great finish, wasn't it? A lovely move. And they're good, Wilson. How well can they do?
I think at some point the limitations of the squad kicks in, but they are playing really well. I think Hasenhüttl's a really, really good manager. I think there's a big danger that Dortmund might come and steal him. But, you know, they were allowed to play well yesterday, first half particularly. The Sheffield United did that classic thing of playing with a high line and then putting no pressure on the ball. But you know, given those opportunities, they played really well. And then when they came under a bit of pressure early in the second half, when Sheffield United improved, they were good enough to see that off and then get the two late goals as well. So I'd be amazed if they got in the Champions League, but they can certainly finish in Europa League places.
Southampton are quite unlucky insofar as any time they have a manager who does well, he gets poached by someone else. You know, it was Ronald Koeman, Pochettino, Hasenhüttl could go to Dortmund. Maybe Arsenal might be after him.
Well, and the other issue they may have, assuming Liverpool buy a centre-back in January to replace Van Dijk, you know, who would you go for at the minute who won't cost too much, who you know can play a hard-pressing style, who's used to the Premier League? Vestergaard's the obvious choice.
That's not fair. Surely it's not fair for Liverpool to buy another Southampton, but they just go somewhere else just for one player.
Well, it's getting to the point where it'd be cheaper for Liverpool to buy the club than to keep buying individual players.
Speaking of high-pressing teams, let's talk about Leeds. They lost 2-1 at home to West Ham. Jonathan, have you calmed down from Jamie Jackson's attack on Marcelo Bielsa yet?
Not really, no.
I could feel the rage coming through the Zoom. I enjoyed it tremendously. There's a question from Chris. When will the Bielsa myth be put to bed? Wilson.
Right, okay. I mean, if Chris were standing in front of me now, I would ask him what he means by the myth. I would ask him if he's actually read a single word that has been written about Bielsa in the past 30 years. Nobody is saying that Bielsa is a guarantor of trophies. Nobody is saying he's a man who comes with a big sack of silverware. But when the day of judgment comes, when we are weighed in the balance, what will matter more? Will it be League Cups? Will it be Community Shields? Will it be all these silver pots? Or will it be the hearts of the people of Yorkshire, of the people of Marseille, of the people of Bilbao, of a grumpy Irishman in Brixton who won't go three stops down the Northern Line for love and yet has given his heart to Marcelo Bielsa?
Paul, could you do a similarly rousing speech about David Moyes? Because he's doing... he's doing really quite well. He's doing better than Bielsa.
I don't have... I would say, you know, I haven't written 5 books about David Moyes and I haven't read 17 books about David Moyes, but that's because nobody's written 17 books about David Moyes. I think, you know, the annals of Moyesian studies are pretty slim. But, you know, the guy... I've always liked him, right? Always liked David Moyes. I think he was unfairly treated at Manchester United. I thought his Everton team were much more attractive to watch than people gave him credit for. I think even Sunderland, you know, okay, but there were still patches. And this West Ham thing.
When? Like, 20 minutes about... to Crystal Palace?
Exactly. I was there. I was there for that match and I saw those 20 minutes and that's what I'm talking about. Thank you for substantiating my point. Right, back to David Moyes. You know, essentially, he is a smart guy who has a lot more people skills than I think people give him credit for. And I think he's, you know, he is... I think if you look at Arnautovic the first time around and Antonio the second, you can see his ability to get inside players' heads and say, listen, I'm going to change what you're doing in the team. I believe you can do it. And away they go and they run. Now, you know, this West Ham team is good when it's conservative. It doesn't quite have, and I think Benrahma getting his first start of the weekend is intriguing. And I think he played down the middle because he's the sort of player who can maybe link up these thirds. And I think, well, you know, they're conservative at the minute, but they are so well drilled. You know, and when you get a team that is that well drilled, it's because the players understand what they're being told. So I think there's so many ways in which, not to mention the way he's managed the noises off, and obviously he's benefited from not having the fans in the stadium letting the team know their dissatisfaction. But, you know, he's dealt with a really problematic club in a really sensible, straightforward way. And it's not a fluke they are where they are on the table.
All right, that'll do for part two. Part three, we'll round up the rest of the Premier League and let Paul speak about Norwich for 1 minute. Welcome to part three of the Guardian Football Weekly. Everton 1, Chelsea 0. Everton are 7th, praise be. Some ammunition for you, Jonathan, from Dennis. Chelsea 6 wins this season against Burnley, Leeds, Sheffield United, Newcastle, Crystal Palace and Brighton. Versus the top 10, 3 draws, 2 defeats, no wins.
But ammunition for me, yeah, I really hate this idea that my criticism of Chelsea has been because of some kind of animus against Lampard. It's just, when they were defending really badly, when they had the worst defensive record of any Chelsea team for 23 years, I pointed it out. When Lampard has behaved in quite a thin-skinned way and has talked ludicrous, sanctimonious bollocks, as he did in Spygate, I've pointed out. I don't have a problem with Lampard beyond that. I think they've played really well the last couple of months. I think they played pretty well on Saturday. My one slight reservation I realised in the context of Saturday, and you know, Saturday they hit the post twice, they could easily have won that game. It was, you know, I thought it was a really good game of football, really enjoyed it. I thought both teams played really well, but it was a sort of 50-50 game, even if Chelsea didn't have a shot on target in the last hour. But one thing that did occur to me was the game against Leeds when I thought they were really, really good and the way they played around Leeds' press, they were brilliant. But Pobeda, if he'd gone down for that penalty when it was 2-1 to Chelsea and Leeds had scored it, suddenly it's 2-2 a quarter of an hour to go. And that could have been 2 cheap points dropped. and they drop points cheaply against Southampton, against West Brom. And that does fit into that pattern of not quite having the game management skills. But, you know, they won that game quite easily in the end, and you could easily win on Saturday.
That looked like, was that Mendy's first mistake as Chelsea goalkeeper? Will the floodgates open now?
It was the first, yeah, first I can remember. But yeah, he's been really good. Keepers make mistakes sometimes. I wouldn't be too terrified by that.
An important, Barry, for Everton to get back to winning ways. They've been on a little poor run, haven't they?
Yeah, obviously they scorched out of the traps at the start of the season, surprised a lot of people, then went into a bit of a slump. They were missing James at the weekend. People were beginning to question his form. I think it may have been down to fatigue after two grueling international breaks. He has a long way to travel, and they needed a win, and that's a statement win, I suppose. But like I say, I didn't think Chelsea played particularly badly.
Newcastle 2, West Brom 1. Ferg says, how poorly can Newcastle play and still get a result? They didn't deserve to beat West Brom or Palace, but they're still getting results. I enjoy Newcastle fans being upset. I mean, I've seen them be really bad this season, and I sympathise with them. I think if you win back-to-back games in the Premier League when you're Newcastle, you should be able to be happy about it.
I thought they deserved to win that game. I thought they played quite well. I thought Steve Bruce was proactive in bringing on two attacking substitutes who ended up deciding the game for them. And I have seen Newcastle stink the place up, but I don't think that game was one such occasion. I thought they were deserved winners. But Newcastle fans disagree emphatically. I think Newcastle could win the league by 15 points, and some of them would still find something to complain about. Why didn't we win it by 18 points? But I sympathise on occasions, but I thought that was a fine performance, and they've won two in a row, and yeah, that any complaints are weird.
A brilliant header from Dwight Gale as well.
Yeah.
Powerful enough to be a bullet header, Wilson, would you say?
Oh, I'd say so, yeah. And I think it was a Chris Wood header that went just wide in the Arsenal-Burnley game. That made me sort of occur to me just how hard heading is. Even people who are really good at heading, quite often it actually skims off her ear or off her shoulder. But that was slap off the middle of her forehead. Great cross, great header, lovely goal.
It's an underrated skill. And also, I think players, speaking from my personal, I head the ball a lot, but I think also I'd be interested to know from elite footballers who are brilliant at heading it, do they find it easier to head a cross coming from one side or the other? Because I find it from the right, I find it much easier to head that ball that way than I do that way. Maybe I'm just, you know, I don't know why that is. But
make sense, because I mean, we all have to some extent a dominant eye, and I guess you have different flexibility in different shoulders and things. I think that's totally reasonable.
I'm going to ask the next centre forward I speak to. Let's talk about Wolves Aston Villa. This wasn't a very good game, was it? But Mike Dean was the hero, dishing out 9 yellow cards and 2 reds. Derek says, after watching the game with all those cards, bearing in mind there wasn't one bad or indeed cynical tackle in the game, are the newest laws turning the game into a non-contact sport, or is most of it down to Mike Dean's arrogance and general bad reffing? Paul?
I don't think it's a non-contact sport. It's just a very different type of contact. I mean, you don't get to go in with studs up on anybody, but you do get to constantly be using your body in order to get an advantage over an opponent. You know, the arse is much more important than the studs nowadays.
I would disagree with the correspondent insofar as I think quite a few of those yellow cards were for cynical fouls. It certainly wasn't a dirty game, but I thought most of those yellows were justified apart from one of Moutinho's second one. I don't think anyone else could have any complaints. It wasn't a dirty game, but it was punctuated by niggly fouls, and many of which were card-worthy.
Jonathan, do you know who might come in as cover for Raul Jimenez?
Should I know this?
Well, you do think he's the greatest footballer of all time.
Oh, really? A Salomon Rondon?
Yes, yeah, absolutely. Rumoured to be coming in.
Who shares his birthday with Lauren Bacall and Neville Southall.
Absolutely. Finally, the Manchester Derby. Manchester United 0, Manchester City 0. R.G. Gray. Was Martin Tyler's De Bruyne, De Gea, Derby the worst bit of commentating of all time, but also simultaneously the most interesting thing to happen in the United City match? It wasn't a very good football match, was it? I don't know what else to say about that game, Jonathan.
Well, I think the interesting thing about it is, and it's sort of interesting after the fact because it was a pretty hard watch, was that Guardiola was clearly relatively happy with a 0-0 draw. He was obviously so concerned, or presumably was so concerned about United's capacity to counter, as he did against them twice in the league last season, that he you know, he didn't feel the need to change the shape of the game. So despite having Phil Foden and Bernardo Silva on the bench, you know, he only made one substitution. So that suggests he sort of thought, yeah, we'll hold this 0-0 and that's fine. So whether you see that as Guardiola learning a pragmatism late in his career, or whether you see that as being a slightly odd and maybe almost slightly cowardly move, I guess that depends what stage of their development you think City are at and what you think their goal for this season is. And I guess this season is different to recent seasons in that, you know, if you extrapolate out Tottenham's points, Tottenham as the leaders, over 38 games, they'll get 79 points. So if 80 points is going to win the league, a point away at United is probably quite a good result.
I think it was pretty obvious both teams were more interested in not losing than winning, and both managers would have happily taken a point before the game.
Paul, Norwich are top of the Championship. Would you like to talk about it?
No, keep it under the radar as far as I'm concerned. That Bournemouth looked good. Bournemouth, whoa, they're scoring goals for fun. I'm sure Bournemouth are an unstoppable juggernaut now who really, really are absolutely nailed on to go up in automatic promotion places.
You do know that you can find the league tables in other places.
Yeah, but you have to actively go and look for them. I don't want to sort of get anybody up thinking I need to look at that league table, see that Norwich are 3 points clear despite not playing very well and despite having as many as 14 injuries to the squad. You don't want to see that. You just want to look at Bournemouth, think, Bournemouth, brilliant. Brilliant. Still such a Premier League squad. Absolutely no chance of them going up in flames. Same with Watford.
It's slightly worrying, actually, that I suppose it's indicative of the gulf in class between the Championship and the Premier League that Bournemouth and Norwich are doing so well. Are Watford doing well as well?
Yeah, Watford are doing well as well.
Yeah, having gone down and lost key players. I mean, Dominic Solanke is scoring goals for fun and he couldn't hit a cow's arse with a banjo in the Premier League, so it is slightly worrying.
I would slightly disagree with that. I think the Championship is a lot stronger, a higher quality than it's ever been. And I think one of the things is that these clubs who got relegated perhaps Watford are the exception, but actually Watford too, they've been buying lots of young players over time. They had squads that were ready to re-emerge in the Championship. Shed a couple of key players now, again, to keep the books balanced. But you have players like João Pedro at Watford, you know, they're number nine now, who wouldn't have really got much time in the Premier League, but is an exceptional player. Solanke, the same. Held on to David Brooks, who is, you know, incredible talent at this level.
Rami says, listening to the last pod and equally feel strongly about how headers are described, if you're a Crystal Palace fan of a certain age and also one who regularly watched season review videos in the 90s, you'll remember a Chris Coleman goal away to West Brom in 1993, famously being described as a meatball header by the commentator. It was from about the edge of the box, and thinking about it now, we probably do need a name for that type of goal. Sorry, wasn't sure who to contact about this. You absolutely contacted the right person. Thank you, Rami. I'm very happy to go with headers from outside the box being called meatball headers.
Well, hang on, though, but there's two different types. Right? There's the looping header when they've seen the keeper off the line.
Yeah.
And then there's the bullet header like Gordon Armstrong against Chelsea in the FA Cup quarterfinal replay in 1992. Or maybe 92, 93-ish was sort of a golden age, this kind of header. So do we know which type of header Coleman's was?
Well, I remember Carlton Palmer scoring one from outside the box. Perhaps a bullet header is a meatball header. Boof. And a looping one is a Cumberland ring. How about that? But look, thanks for listening anyway. And that'll do for today's podcast. Thanks for your time, Paul.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Barry.
You're welcome.
Cheers, Wilson.
Cheers.
We'll be back tomorrow.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.